Okay, Anton, thank you very much for the invitation and also the nice introduction. It's my honor to be here. Actually, my first trip to Toronto. I learned how to pronounce it. No T's, no second T's. So today I want to tell you two stories. First one is about trying to look at the properties of DNA at a very short length scale using biophysical tools. And second is using the DNA for cell biology in a way that nature never intended. Okay, that's why I call it repurposing the double helix. DNA is an eicodic molecule. So this is actually a clay structure on the hill of Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. Children are playing there. Some people are so enthusiastic about the DNA, so they have tattoos on their body. And he's trying to figure out where life leads to by climbing up the DNA, one step at a time. Of course, this is a famous picture of Watson and Crick playing with their model structure, trying to deduce the structure of the DNA 60 years ago. So this is a picture taken from the famous Nature paper by Watson and Crick. This actually was drawn by the wife of Francis Crick on the dinner table, and proposing the double helical structure of the DNA. This paper ended with this paragraph. It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material. It's a very modest statement. In fact, many people consider this to be the understatement of the century. And in fact, the guys actually got worried that someone else may propose this idea in a more explicit manner and take the credit along with the big prize. So they actually rushed to publish another paper next month in Nature, proposing this base pairing-based copying in a very explicit manner. And the rest became history, and so on. Just to give you some physical dimensions for the DNA, the diameter of the DNA is about 2 nanometers, or 20 angstroms. And one base pair of DNA is 3.4 angstroms. And 10 base pairs make one helical turn. The pitch of DNA is 10 base pairs, about 34 angstroms. Do you know how much DNA you make in your lifetime? So if you have your single cell in your body and then you put DNA back to back, then you have two meters of DNA. And in your lifetime, you make one light year of DNA. Basically 10 to 16 meters. And mainly because you have 10 to 14 cells in your body. And DNA is also charged. So on the DNA backbone, you have phosphates that are charged negatively. So you have one unit charge every 6 angstroms. And it turns out that the electrostatic energy between the two unit charges separated by 6 angstroms in water is about the thermal energy, KT, at room temperature. So electrostatic effects are very important also for DNA molecules. Okay, how do you form a DNA? You can form a single strand of DNA by putting together what's called a nucleotide. So that's the nucleotide. So you have the sugar ring here, and that's the phosphate negatively charged phosphate group, and that's a base. Okay. And so phosphate, sugar, and base. And I have translation for those who can read Chinese. Actually, it's Korean. I have my college friends actually here on the faculty, 3 of them, so it's really impressive. Usually I don't find a single person from my college in a seminar trip, but I find 3, so it's amazing. You guys are lucky. so then you put together nucleotides forming DNA backbone, and bases are sticking out, and you can have different colors artificially here for different bases, A, T, C, and G. And then this pairs up with another strand with matching bases, A pairs with T, and C pairs with G, and so on. So that's how you build a double helical DNA structure. Well, DNA is 2 meters long. Your cell is only maybe 100 microns long. So to put that DNA into the cell, then you have to compact the DNA, starting from the linear DNA all the way to the chromosome. And the first level of compaction is by forming a structure shown here. It's called a nucleosome. And then you can compact it even more until you get the chromosome level. What's interesting about this structure is that DNA is tightly wrapped around a protein core, and a very beautiful structure that immediately tells you, you know, how you can actually achieve compaction at the molecular level. DNA in abstraction, so you can view the DNA as double helix or a cylinder or two lines running with bases, you know, pairing with each other. You can also draw the DNA as two arrows that are running in opposite directions because, you know, they are running, they are antipolar structures. So in fact, a DNA strand has a polarity called 5 prime and 3 prime end based on the chemical structure. In fact, as you know, many of you know, physical review letters, they when they publish your papers, they tend to spell out your acronyms. So if you put down AFM for, you know, atomic force microscope, they will not even ask you before they spelling it out to antiferromagnetism and so on, right? So one of my friends published a paper saying that, oh, you know, he had a 3 prime DNA, right? And then they spelled it out to a three foot DNA. That's okay because three feet is about 1 meter, so that's about the DNA you have in your cell. So anyway, DNA has polarity, so they go run again, you know, like that. And if you increase the temperature, then the entropy effects becomes very important. So the disordered polymer in the coiled state becomes more favorable, and so you can go from the duplex to single strands. So many years ago, people in Steve Chu labs used a method called optical trap to stretch the DNA. So what they did was they attached DNA to a small particle, and then they grabbed it using, you know, focused laser beam, you know, in one place. And then they used a flow of the solution to stretch the DNA through viscous drag. And you can visualize the stretched DNA by staining the DNA with dye molecules. Many dyes are attached to the DNA to allow you to see it. And then when you stop the flow, holding on to the end of the DNA, then DNA recoils. This is as a function of time to become more and more compact because the DNA at that length scale here is 30 microns. It's actually highly flexible. So if you let it, you know, relax, then you basically get a spaghetti dish. So DNA is considered to be a worm-like chain. Let's imagine a worm, and then you can hold the two ends of the worm and mechanically stretch the worm. And you measure the length of the worm as a function of force. So that's basically force versus extension experiment. And Busmantel lab did it 20 years ago, and they measured this response very precisely from a single DNA molecule. And then Marco and Sigia used a modified polymer model based on the worm-like chain model to fit the data, and that's the black line here. It's actually a very amazing fit because it actually agrees with the data over 3 decades of force values. This is log scale. And what is a worm-like chain model? Well, if you imagine a contour And when you go from this position here to another position away, s distance away, if you plot the tangential vectors T0 and TS, and if you take the dot product and then you average over all possible configurations of a polymer, then this one decays exponentially as a function of distance, and that decay length scale is called the persistence length. And for double-stranded DNA, it's been measured to be about 50 nanometers, about 150 base pairs of DNA, because each base pair is about 0.3 nanometers. So what's amazing about this is that when they fit the data using this model, our agreement was really good, even though they completely ignored the atomic structures of the DNA. All the chemical structures were ignored. They just viewed it as a mechanical beam, rod, that is flexible. But they could fit the data extremely well, so that's really amazing. And this has been used to really understand mechanical measurements of DNA and other proteins very precisely. Another way of looking at the Wormlike chain model and DNA flexibility is to look at a factor called J factor. What is a J factor? J factor is the effective concentration of the one end of the DNA molecule in the vicinity of the other end. Okay. All right. So let me just explain it again. So if you have a worm, and then worm is wiggling around, effective concentration of one end relative to the other is not zero, because there's some chance that the two can come together. But if you bring a knife and cut it into a very short piece, then basically two ends will never meet each other. So J becomes very, very small. Okay? So basically the idea here is that if you make the DNA shorter and shorter, and compared to the 150 base pairs, which is the persistence length of the DNA, then the J factor should drop dramatically. This is log scale. This is what the theory suggests. Basically, then the two ends of the DNA can never meet if the DNA becomes shorter than 100 base pairs. So that's the prediction. By the way, the oscillation here is due to the fact that DNA also has a torsional stiffness. It's a double helical structure, so there's a 10 base pair period there. But if you look at DNA in biology, it's bound to many different kind of proteins, and tightly bound DNA is very it's everywhere. Okay, so this is a virus particle, 30 nanometers in size, and you can pack lots of DNA there. I told you about the nucleosome, and a diameter is 10 nanometers. Five times smaller than the so-called persistence length. DNA wraps around the protein core very nicely. And there are many, many other examples. So if you actually, you can write down, based on the Wormlike chain model, calculate the energy cost of forming a circle relative to the thermal energy. And for that's the number of base pairs on the DNA. So if you have 100 base pair long DNA, then this number becomes 30. 30 times kT is actually a lot of energy to borrow from thermal fluctuations. So basically, if you wait for it to happen, it's not going to happen, right? So according to the Wormlike chain model, then these type of structures will never form, okay, spontaneously. But there was a paper published about 10 years ago by John Widom's group, late John Widom, saying that double-stranded DNA at a short length scale can be actually much more flexible than what people thought. So that was the motivation for our own study. For that, I need to explain what they did. So there is a method called cyclization using an enzyme called the ligase. The idea is that if you have double-stranded DNA with two single-stranded ends that are complementary to each other, then at some point in time, they can come close to each other. And then two ends can base pair to form a mini circle. And then you put this protein called ligase, and again, you can come and stitch the DNA molecules together to form covalently closed DNA circle. Okay? And And the idea is that this will be more easier to achieve if the DNA is more flexible. Okay? But if you do the measurement in solution, in the tube, then with many DNA molecules, you can get this, but you can also get linear dimers or circular dimers, and so many different products can be formed. So what people usually do is to run the reaction and then run it on a gel. Basically, based on the size, they can run at different speed on the electric field. And then you can see different kinds of bands. And then you can estimate how much of the circular molecule you get versus a linear dimer. And then based on the measurement, you can actually calculate the J factor, actually concentration of one end of the DNA relative to the other. So John Wilson's lab did that experiment. But for the first time for DNA molecules that are as short as 100 base pairs, so these are their measurement values, J factors, and as a function of length. And this is the Wormlike chain model. And they found that their measured values are about 1,000 times higher than the Wormlike chain model prediction. So there was a conundrum reported by this group. So it was a very interesting time. And it was quickly followed by a couple of theoretical papers. Basically, they say that if you assume that the DNA molecule can form a kink locally or a small bubble to make the DNA flexible only locally at short length scale, then you can explain the data. Still maintaining the agreement with the long length scale measurements. But then there's another group published a paper saying that, well, that was because the Whedon group didn't use the correct protein concentration. If you use the right correct concentration, then you get a perfect agreement with the Wormlike chain model. Whereas if you don't use the correct concentration, you get the deviation. So there was actually a disagreement in the community back then. And it didn't actually stop there. And then there's another paper from a large-scale collaboration. Basically, they used an AFM to image DNA on a microsurface. And by following the contour carefully, they were also able to deduce that DNA is more flexible than the Wormlike chain model prediction. And it is still continuing. So we thought that maybe we can do somewhat better, cleaner experiment by realizing that there are limitations in existing approaches. So some measurements can only be done under limited conditions. And you cannot really measure real-time looping of the DNA. And most of the measurement require proteins and so on. So we wanted to do something different. So it was my student, Reza Vafabaksh, who decided to do this project. So he developed a protein-free single molecule method and discovered extreme flexibility of short double-stranded DNA. So that's what I want to tell you about. So we use a method called FRET. And the idea here is that if you have a fluorescent molecule called donor or in a green dye, and you excite the molecule with a laser, then you get a green photon out, unless you bring the second molecule of different color close by within a few nanometers, then they can talk to each other, dipole-dipole interaction. The energy can be transferred from the excited state directly, and then you get the red photon instead. And this is a very strong function of distance between the two, distance R, the sixth power. And here, R0 is the distance at which energy transfer becomes 1/2. So it tells you basically where if you excite the green molecule 100 times, how many times you see a signal from the red molecule. And this is a strong function of distance. So if you have the two molecules very close to each other, you get mainly red emission. And when they are far away from each other, you get mainly green emission, and vice versa. So I have a friend in Korea who is in the movie industry. Actually, what he does is to make TV commercials mainly. But I told him about our technique, and then he made this movie for me. So, So there's two proteins on the membrane moving around. When they approach each other, you see color change because of energy transfer. So that's the idea. You can do this from many molecules simultaneously. So if you tether, in this case, an RNA molecule to a surface, and then the RNA molecule goes back and forth between folded and unfolded states, and that you can see, you know, as a force-colored a movie here. So if you look at one spot, you can see that the color is changing between red and yellow, and due to the folding-unfolding reactions. So if you plot the intensities of the red and green colors as a function of time, you see they are going up and down in an anticorrelated manner. And you can also plot what's called the Fred efficiency, which is actually red over the total intensity. So when Fred is high, then two dyes are close to each other, and when Fred is low, two dyes are far away from each other. So you can measure this very nicely from many molecules in parallel. So this is our experiment. So we made a DNA molecule of various total lengths, as shown here. And then we added 10 bases of 10 nucleotides of single-stranded overhangs that are complementary to each other. Okay? And then we have the green and white dye molecules on the DNA. And we put a small molecule called biotin somewhere in the DNA to immobilize the DNA to a surface in a very specific manner. And then we start the experiment under a condition that doesn't favor the loop state. Basically, if you have very little salt in solution, then because of electrostatic repulsion between the negative charges, you get something like this. And then what you get is, as a function of time, mainly emission from the green molecule, low Fred efficiency because the dyes are far away from each other. And then we introduce ions to solution to induce the looping. And then when looping occurs, then you see a sudden increase in the Fred efficiency. So that's basically a very simple signal. Just you go from one color to another abruptly. And what we do is we measure how long it takes to do this. So if the DNA is more flexible, then it'll happen more quickly and vice versa. So that's observable. And in fact, this is a very robust experiment. So you have many DNA molecules on the surface showing up on the green channel, donor channel, at t equals 0. Very little on the red channel, acceptor channel. And then 20 minutes later, then you know most of them have shifted to the right side. They really form the loop. So you can measure this as a function of time and show that this is a histogram of the Fred efficiency as a function of time. At the beginning, you get the linear DNA with basically zero Fred, and then as time goes on, this population goes down, the circle increases in number, and so you can actually plot the fraction of the looped molecules as a function of time and show that you know you can actually get a nice single exponential change. So when I showed this data for the first time in public, there were a lot of experts in the room. This was about 20 minutes to do this, and the response was very interesting. Some people said that, oh, this is much slower than they expected, and others said that this is much faster than what they expected. And I realized that we are measuring the right thing because mainly we had no idea how fast this should happen. Right? So we did it for many different DNA lengths. So you can, from about, I think, 107 base pairs down to 67 base pairs. This is log scale of looping time. And you can see some oscillations. But the bottom line is that the length dependence is not very strong. Okay, so when you go from 107 to 70, 67, much shorter than the persistent length, where J factor should drop very dramatically, 2N should never really meet. But despite that expectation, we see a pretty decent looping rate, right? So that was surprising to me. Again, because that's, you expect the J factor to drop very dramatically when you go below 100 base pairs by orders of magnitude. So we then worried about many different artifacts. So we thought maybe because we are tethering the DNA to a surface using this small molecular glue called biotin, and modification or tethering could actually cause the DNA to loop more quickly. So we did a control experiment. We put the DNA into a small vesicle container, a few hundred nanometers in diameter, so that we can actually look at the DNA again in the same manner by tethering the vesicle to a surface. And but the DNA itself is not tethered to anything. It's not modified with a biotin. So we can still do the same experiment and measure the looping time. So the results are shown in red symbols. They basically follow the same pattern as the measurement done on the surface. So we don't think it is a surface effect that is causing this unusually high flexibility of the DNA. Another thing that you can ask is that, well, maybe we picked a DNA sequence that is very pathological by accident. It's just very unusually flexible DNA. So what we did was, we picked one length of DNA shown here, and that's our original sequence, 73 base pairs, R for random, that we picked. And then we just tried a few different sequences of the same length. It turns out that some sequences are even faster looping than our sequence. Others are slower. So this means that it's really not because we picked very unusual DNA sequence, right? It's just our sequence is nothing unusual, really. So we don't think this is due to a pathological DNA sequence. Then we can actually try to convert our looping time or looping rate to the J factor by using this. Basically, because J factor is the concentration of the two ends relative to each other, if you then multiply this by the biomolecular reaction rate, Kon, then you can get the looping rate. So by simply dividing the looping rate that we measure by Kon, you can get the J factor. And we can actually measure that looping rate in the same manner as that I did before, except that we have now two DNA molecules. One is carrying a red on the surface. The other is coming with green. You simply measure how long it takes for the two to find each other in the same way. And then you can get the Kon value, and then you can calculate the J factor from the same set of data. So that's shown here. So we're comparing the J factor estimation to the, this traditional Wormlike chain model. There's a big disagreement. But because we are using 10 bases overhang instead of, four that people used to use before, we thought you have to probably relax the boundary conditions more to make a better comparison. So we actually did two additional boundary conditions to model this. But none of this was enough to bring the theoretical curves to our data, at least 100-fold difference between the two. So we think that our data cannot be explained by the standard Wormlike chain model, even with the most liberal boundary conditions. So we propose this, that DNA is extremely flexible at a short length scale, indeed. And what it implies for biology is that because the DNA has its intrinsic flexibility, protein does not have to actually induce the tightly bent DNA. It just needs to wait until the DNA forms this spontaneously looped or bent state, and then simply bind, stabilize that structure. So that is one implication of the data. The proteins may have learned through evolution to work with this intrinsic DNA property of flexibility. So maybe it's not so difficult to bend after all. Last piece of data that I want to show you on this part is that because we don't use proteins to measure DNA flexibility, then we can then add proteins to see how proteins can affect DNA flexibility. So here is a protein that is known to bend the DNA. And then if you add the protein, as you increase the protein concentration, the rate of looping also increases dramatically by a factor of 100. So in the cell, your DNA will not be free of proteins, there will be proteins. And our data show that DNA is very flexible. And then because proteins are also in the cell, then DNA is even more flexible. So basically, you know, we think that there's no need to worry about DNA not being flexible enough in the cell to do important biological reactions. So that was what the Reza did. He just left my group to do a postdoc at Berkeley in cell biology. So the second part is shorter, and it's about the use of double helix for doing something that nature never intended. And it was motivated by our center that we started 4.5 years ago through a Physics Frontier Center grant from National Science Foundation. So I'm a PI of this center called Center for the Physics of Living Cells. You know, we have positions for postdoctoral fellows, graduate and fellows, so you guys are welcome to apply. And so as I showed you earlier, we do mainly single molecule measurements in a test tube, you know, highly purified DNA or proteins. But when we proposed our center, we promised that we'll study cells, living cells, because that's the next frontier. And it was nice because we didn't know how to do it, right? So that's why it was a good, you know, it's a proposal, right? So that is a cell. It was our inspiration, basically more as to where we want to go, right? So that's why I have Bastina name. So, and because of the proposal that was funded with this name, we had to do some things in living cells, right? So I'm going to tell you about our living cell project. Right, the cell, our human cell actually is pretty much a sphere in free solution. It looks like spherical cell. But of course, you know, we don't have isolated cells in our body, you know, to form tissues. They have to, you know, bind each other or bind to other surfaces to really form our tissues, like our skins and, you know, heart and so on. So adhesion between the cells or adhesion between a cell and a surface is very important in biology. So if you actually start with a spherical cell and then put it on a glass surface that has the right kind of proteins, then cell will land and then form, you know, basically bonds, you know, all kinds of glues with the surface to spread, adhere and spread on the surface. So I'll show you a movie I took from Michael Shih's paper. He's in Columbia University. So you start with a spherical cell and then take a movie of cell landing on a glass surface and then spread. Okay, and the glass surface has some proteins and so on. I don't think they caught the very beginning. Anyway, so so you can start from a sphere or egg, and then you can make a fried egg, okay? Very, very quickly. And there are lots of things moving in the cell, too. But anyway, so for this to happen, you have to have certain proteins on the cell membrane to bind to some target molecules on the surface, and then establish good junctions, right? And this is very important for many processes in biology. So in particular, there's a very famous protein called integrin. It has nothing to do with, you know, calculus. And basically, these integrins are proteins on the cell membrane, shown in red, and then these proteins bind to other proteins on the surface to, you know, spread, right? Adhere and spread. So we are looking at this integrin, and then RGD is actually, you know, three amino acid peptide sequence that is found in these proteins that we usually put on the glass surface to allow cells to adhere and spread. So this is actually a small molecule ligand that can bind to a particular integrin protein in the cell membrane to support cell adhesion and spreading. So you can imagine that when the cell is trying to adhere, then it'll use integrin to hold a bind to the ligand and then, you know, try to pull and see, okay, is it stable enough, right? Sense how stiff the surface is. If the surface is stiff enough, then the cell will adhere. So people have done this, you know, by changing the stiffness of the glass surface and see how cells change their behaviors. But we thought maybe you can also measure the single molecular forces, because the sensing is done by a single molecule. Then, you know, what kind of force the cell is applying to sense how stiff the surface is. So basically, you know, the question here is that how much force is applied on a single integrin ligand bond for cells to adhere and spread. So that was the question that we wanted to address. So we developed a method that we called tension gauge tether, TGT. So that's the idea. So, you know, ideally, you like to just develop a scale so you can measure the weight of force directly. But this is actually very difficult to do so. So instead, what we are doing is this. So if you have a rope connecting, to a weight, this is a weight that you are trying to determine. But if the rope is known to break at 10 newtons of force, and if the rope breaks, then we know that the force weight must be larger than 10 newtons, right? But if you use another rope that breaks at 15 newtons of force, and then and it endures, then the force or weight must be less than 15 newtons. So by doing this differential measurement, you can do some thinking, right, and then deduce that, okay, the force being applied is between 10 and 15 piconewtons. So that's our tension gauge tether. All right, so I have a cell membrane and this integrin protein, or it's called also receptor. Let's say this is a mechanosensitive receptor. It depends on the tension, it'll become active or not. And then on the surface, you have ligand bound to the surface through a tether with a low tension tolerance. Then when the cell lands on the surface, pull on the receptor, and then tether will break. Okay, so then cell will not adhere, because now whatever is needed to activate cannot be activated. Instead, if you have a ligand bound to the surface with a much stronger tether of high tension tolerance, then the tether will endure, and then you'll activate whatever you need to activate, then cells will adhere and spread. Okay, so that's the idea. So our tether is based on DNA. Again, so that's where we have this repurposing part that comes in. We have duplex DNA. And then on one end, we have the ligand that we want to pull on. And the other end of the DNA has a biotin molecule linked to it. It's a kind of vitamin E that binds to a protein called avidin very specifically. So we can immobilize the DNA to a surface very nicely. And then it's known that only about 10 piconewton of force is needed to unzip the DNA if you apply force in this configuration. Okay? So this is a low tension tolerance tether. But if you move the biotin to the other end of the DNA, then the cell will apply the force on the DNA in a shear configuration, and that requires about 60 piconewtons of force to melt the DNA into single strands. So that's a high rupture force. And then if you move the biotin to different positions on the DNA, then you can have intermediate tension tolerance values. So that's the idea. It's very nice because actually Dijan did a theory for DNA shear force application and melting. And then Mauro Prentis in Harvard did an experiment to actually estimate the forces. So we can use their analysis to estimate the rupture force as a function of this position of the biotin on the DNA. And so we made 9 different DNA structures with 9 different tension tolerance values. And they are shown here. And we are just marching along the DNA by moving the biotin from one position to another. And estimated tension tolerance values range from 12 piconewton up to 56 piconewton. We also put a diameter molecular size G on the top strand so that when the DNA is gone, broken, you know, then you can also see the fluorescence loss. So what we do is that we just then, you know, have a glass cover slip, and we put 2 millimeter diameter spots on the surface, and you can see them by fluorescence. And then we put it on a petri dish, and then we add the cell solution, and then you let the cells grow for half an hour, and then you gently wash the cells, and then see, okay, how many cells are, you know, adhering to the surface. And then basically by looking at the cells using, you know, just regular microscope, you know, no fluorescence, no single molecule measurement, you can hopefully see what's going on. So we think this is like a test paper, like a pH paper for molecular tension with piconewton sensitivity. And you don't really need anything fancy to do this. So that's the actual image of 9 different spots, 9 different forces. And then after half an hour, you look at this field of view, and you can see some spots there. And you can zoom in and show that, yeah, there are cells actually there, and where you have this ligand immobilized through the DNA. So you do the same for a lower force, 54, and they would show the same density, and 50 piconewton, and you see some reduction at 43, and boom, here you see a big reduction in number of cells adhering to the surface. And when you go to lower forces, basically, very little of the cells actually adhere. So there must be a boundary right here of at around 40 piconewton of force that actually allow the cells to adhere. So during the adhesion process, it must be the cells apply force around 40 piconewtons. This is just a zoom in of different force surfaces showing the boundary right here. You can also count the number of cells on the surface as a function of, you know, per imaging area, and show that that cell count has a sharp threshold effect at that force. So we think that the cells we study here exert 40 piconewtons of maximum tension on the boundary adhesion. And then we ask ourselves, is it actually also true for other types of cells? Is it just specific, you know, effect of this particular cell that we study? So we then knocked on the doors of many biology labs on campus to get cells, you know, this is human breast cancer cells, same threshold. And this is the HeLa cell. This is, I think, cervical cancer cells, same boundary here. Human embryonic kidney cells, same boundary, and same boundary for this one, and so on. Basically, all of them show the same threshold. So it must be a universal value that is true for all of these cells that we looked at. Just to summarize the second part, so we think that actually we can use this method as a tension measurement tool to measure the single molecular forces required to activate some of the cellular processes. And data suggests that the cells can apply a universal tension of a defined value on a single bond during the adhesion process. And we also showed that you can use this as a way to provide a defined mechanical niche to the cells and see how the cells respond using many standard imaging technologies available for cell biological studies. So the second part was done by my postdoc, Zhifeng Wang, who is really brilliant and very creative. And he has a lot of most interesting research. I hope you will have a chance to hear about it from him directly in the future. So let me stop here. And again, thank you very much for your attention.